Africa Today.
English-speaking regions of Cameroon have for decades complained of marginalization, particularly in education and legal systems, by the Francophone-dominated government. These grievances have triggered widespread protests and violence since October 2016. Over the past few months, there has been an alarming spike in attacks on schools and education centers in the north and southwest of Cameroon. In one such incident last October, at least 8 children were killed and a dozen wounded after attackers stormed a school in Kumba. One of the affected parents speaks out on the death of her daughter.
My heart bleeds a lot because her death was so tragic. She went through a lot of pain.
We want peace, no more killing.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenyam, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the Anglophone crisis in Cameroon. We are discussing the underlying reasons for violence, which continues to impact negatively on lives of people in the region. In the second part of our program, we shall be talking about the impact of Brexit on Africa and how Britain is undermining regional economic blocs in Africa in pursuit of its economic interests.
Cameroon's Anglophone crisis. Cameroon, a former German colony, was divided between the Allied French and British victors at the end of World War I. In 1960, France granted independence to its colony. Britain, however, had a different proposition. A United Nations referendum was held in British Cameroons on 11th of February 1961 to determine whether the territory should join neighboring Cameroon or Nigeria. The Anglophone Cameroonians who opted in that referendum to form a federation with French Cameroon. However, they have since felt increasingly marginalized by the French-speaking government in Yaoundé, hundreds of miles away. In October 2017, militant secessionist groups symbolically proclaimed the independence of a new nation. In these 4 years, clashes between the Cameroon military and separatist fighters have led to over 3,000 deaths and many displaced persons. People in the English-speaking regions have often claimed they are being unfairly treated by Paul Biya's French-centered government. Biya has been Cameroon's president since 1982.
In June 2020, the Norwegian Refugee Council declared the conflict in Cameroon as the most neglected crisis on the planet for a second year running. Opposition leaders are blaming the government for imposing a military solution to a political problem.
This crisis is a political one, and we expect the government to address a political solution to it. As of now, we are seeing that a military solution that is being given to a political crisis.
Now, for more analysis on the protracted Anglophone crisis in Cameroon, we contacted Kawala, the president of the Cameroon People's Party. She's an entrepreneur and social activist who was a presidential candidate back in 2011. Thanks, madam, for your time. Now, as we know, the Anglophone crisis, which is a relic of colonialism, has led to pain and suffering in Cameroon. Now, what is really happening?
This problem is 60 years old, and today the result is over 4,000 people who have been killed, close to a million people, so 700,000 and more are internally displaced in Cameroon. About 60,000 are refugees in neighboring Nigeria. We have over 600,000 children whose schooling has been compromised. Every single day in Cameroon, somebody is being killed in the Anglophone regions. And very, very often, this includes the civilians. So more than 50% of those who are killed are civilians, and women and children.
Thanks for that, Ms. Wala, the president of Cameroon's People's Party.
France, which has significant business interests in its former colony, has been careful not to overly criticize the government's handling of the crisis. Human rights advocates and scholars have blamed French President Emmanuel Macron for providing military and political support to the Paul Biya regime that is suppressing the English-speaking regions.
The Cameroon Anglophone crisis has been described by some analysts as Rwanda in slow motion, a reference to the genocide that occurred in Rwanda in 1994, when nearly 1 million people, most of them from the Tutsi minority group, were slaughtered by Hutu extremists in a space of a few months. Now, France is accused of having assisted the perpetrators of the Rwanda genocide and is now facing similar accusations in Cameroon. Ms. Walla, are the former colonial powers, especially France, involved in any way in fomenting the crisis in Cameroon?
France especially. So when the British left, they left. They have very few economic interests in Cameroon. They have very, very little political influence over Cameroon. But the French remained a very strong partner of Cameroon. And throughout our history, the French have been, they have never favored the Anglophone part of the country being fully integrated into the country. They have had a kind of fear and a kind of rejection of the Anglophones. So today, the French are perceived as an ally of a very dictatorial government that we have.
In 2019, President Paul Biya called for national dialogue in a bid to put an end to the conflict between security forces and armed separatists from the Anglophone minority. However, the dialogue process failed to halt the violence. Addressing the nation on 31st of December last year, President Biya said his government has continued to demonstrate its commitment to openness and dialogue.
Our government has continued to demonstrate its commitment to openness and dialogue by, for example, releasing many former secessionists and facilitating their reintegration into society. Furthermore, after the major national dialogue, the government fast-tracked the implementation of an ambitious decentralization policy, which includes a special status for our northwest and southwest regions, which takes into account their specificities and aspirations.
The government says it is committed to dialogue. What was the outcome of the dialogue between the government and the secessionists in Cameroon?
The secessionists, who are, you know, the armed group on the ground, were not present in the dialogue as a movement. There were some individuals there who claimed that they used to be armed fighters who had put down their guns, but they were not there to speak in the name of this movement. So this was not a dialogue that you could speak of. There were, you could not see two parties clearly represented. You could not see a neutral facilitator that had credibility with the different warring factions. It was a farce organized by the government to sort of tick the box and to sort of get people off their backs because there had been such a strong demand for dialogue.
Thousands of small-scale farmers in Cameroon's English-speaking southwest and northwest regions have been forced off their land by armed conflict between government forces and Anglophone separatists. Now, how has the Anglophone crisis impacted on Cameroon's economy, especially the affected regions?
A war economy has installed itself in these two regions. So the population and especially economic actors are being extorted both by the armed groups and by the army. And so you find that people, to be able to get out their agricultural produce, to be able to get out their merchandise, are having to pay to whoever is controlling, whichever person with a gun is controlling that part of the armed, that part of the territory. The other thing is that smuggling has greatly
Thanks, Ms. Walla, for that insight. Now, are regional bodies such as ECOWAS and the African Union playing an active role in ending the Anglophone crisis in Cameroon?
At this time, it's very unclear for us whether the African Union does not see this as a priority crisis, does not see all of these people dying as being a matter of extreme urgency. For us as Cameroonians, it is a matter of extreme urgency as we lose people every single day. The deaths are horrific. The violence, including gender-based violence against women. We have children dying in this conflict. We are not seeing the support of other African countries and from the African Union that we would have hoped to get.
Well, we do hope that the African Union will take action and resolve the neglected Anglophone crisis in Cameroon for peace and prosperity to return.
Brexit's impact on Africa.
Britain exited the European Union on the 31st January 2020. The status of Britain's relationship with the European Union following the end of the transition period on the 31st December 2020 remains uncertain. This ambiguity extends to the political and economic trading relationships that Britain is having with non-EU countries, including African countries.
During the inaugural 2020 UK-Africa summit, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said his country had all it took to become Africa's obvious partner of choice for doing business post-Brexit when it was no longer tethered to European Union trade agreements with the continent. However, the summit was not welcomed by many. Demonstrators and activists gathered outside the venue in London to express their opposition to this summit.
The UK-Africa Forum has been held in London, with the UK government hosting business leaders to discuss future investment in Britain. The event was attended by business leaders who rubbed shoulders with around 20 African heads of state. The event was also attended by Prince Harry, with UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson also present in order to give a keynote speech. Activists outside the prestigious venue, however, made their views known about why they had decided to oppose the forum and everything it represented.
During the summit, Johnson appeared to be on an aggressive campaign to dump Britain's consumer products in Africa. One of Britain's plans includes selling frozen chicken to Angola. This vast southern African country is buying frozen chicken from Britain, yet it has untapped potential to produce enough poultry for local consumption and export.
Families across Angola will shortly be tucking into delicious, wholesome chicken from Northern Ireland.
Johnson seeks Britain's renewed engagement with Africa while he has been quoted as saying colonialism in Africa should never have ended. An article written by the Prime Minister while he was a Tory MP reveals he also downplayed Britain's role in the slave trade.
So far, Britain has inked a post-Brexit trade deal with 13 African countries. For more on how Brexit has impacted on Africa, we contacted Mr. Africa Kiza, a development anthropologist and a trade policy analyst at the Southern and Eastern Africa Trade Information and Negotiations Institute in Uganda. Now, Mr. Kiza, after Brexit, are we going to see Britain moving to exert its economic influence in Africa?
Now, with Britain ceasing to be part of the EU, the only solution on how it can maintain its firm grip, its imperialistic grip on its former colonies, is through negotiating the same unfair free trade agreements with the same rigged rules and double standards with the countries of Africa, and after even the Caribbean and the Pacific. So I can see Britain maintaining stance on ensuring that these free trade agreements promote its continued access to cheap raw materials, continued access to liberalized markets for its finished manufactured commodities to access African markets. So I keep seeing Britain pushing for the same unfair trade policies and economic policies in Africa.
Well, you have it there. Britain will continue pushing its unfair trade policies on African countries. Last December, Britain signed an economic partnership agreement with Kenya, which was worth £1.4 billion in 2019. Now, the deal was signed in London by Britain's International Trade Minister and Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Trade.
In our estimation, if we were to even capture 5% of the UK market of the goods that we produce and export, in our estimation, our exports could be more than 3 trillion in a very, very short time.
Mr. Kiza, now, do you think Britain's trade deals with individual African countries will undermine regional economic blocs?
Take an example of the East African community. Under the Common Market Protocol and under the treaty establishing the East African community, we are supposed to negotiate free trade agreements with third parties as one single entity, as one bloc. But the current move by Britain to negotiate, to cherry pick, it is more of a divide and rule. It is looking for Kenya, which is more vulnerable because Kenya is a middle-income country, and it will cease accessing Britain's market at a duty-free, quota-free, and it knows that Kenya will start having a lot of revenue losses when its goods to Britain start attracting high tariffs. When you look at the report of the Sector Council on Trade and Investment and Finance for 2020, which was held in September 2020, we wrote to the envoy of Britain asking that we should negotiate the FTA with Britain as one single entity because we are a customs union and we have one common external tariff. Britain rejected.
Before Kenya concluded bilateral trade agreement with Britain, it had already started talks for a similar agreement with the United States, a move that was criticized by the African Union. The immediate former Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, Makisa Kitui, has said that Kenya should consider going with the rest of the continent to the negotiation table with the United States.
So I would have thought that I'll give priority to collective negotiation for enhancement of our goal. If it fails, then I can say, can we try to do something on the retail market? Because if you negotiate with the rest of Africa, you have more muscle to deal with the Commerce Department in Washington than if you go as one country.
Mr. Kiza, you gave an example of how Britain is pursuing a divide-and-rule approach in trade agreements, and this is wrecking the East African community. Now, the United States also appears to be reading from the same script as Britain. Now, as you know, trading within the African continental free trade area started on the 1st of January 2021. Now, do you think this nascent agreement will fall prey to the divisive approach by Western countries in Africa?
Challenge here is that Britain deals with African countries, risk undermining policy space, but also preferential arrangements under the African continental free trade area, especially if we grant more trade preferences to Britain than what we will grant to ourselves respectively under the African continental free trade area. So it would have been better for Britain to adhere to the advice of the African ministers on trade, who had called for African member states to cease negotiating reciprocal free trade agreements with third parties until we have fully ratified and implemented the AfCFTA.
When Boris Johnson announced his plans to make Britain Africa's investment partner of choice post-Brexit, he was well aware that he has to contend with China's power in Africa.
Because I appreciate, as I said, that there is no shortage of governments out there touting for your business. China, I mustn't mention the competition, but why not? China.
Is Britain's renewed interest in Africa aimed at undermining China's influence in Africa?
Politicians often refer to China as our Chinese friends. So that narrative has deeply entrenched itself in the economic aspects and in the economic doctrines of Africa. And for Britain to break, there's the only way for Britain to break that continued growing link is through pursuing its own economic interests. And Britain has a game here, because when you look at East African communities' exports to Europe, to EU, Britain alone accounts for 32.6% of those exports. So we realize that Britain knows that it is a big market for, unfortunately, primary commodities coming from East African community countries like Kenya.
Mr. Kiza there says that Britain wants to create a stalemate in Sino-African relations. Now, that appears to be an insurmountable task. Now, how can African countries secure their interests and avoid falling prey of loop-sided economic deals with the European Union, Britain, and other world powers?
Now, the only way of gaining independence from foreign influence, especially from in accepting unfair economic terms, including trade free and unfair free trade agreements, is through ensuring that we finance our own development budgets as African countries, which we should often present before the interested parties like Britain. Should Britain seek to have negotiating free trade agreements with Africa, we should present our own text.
Well, there you have it. African countries need to finance their own budgets instead of relying on Western donors. They also need to draw up their own terms and conditions before engaging in trade negotiations. Here at Africa Today, we shall keep you posted on trade issues affecting the African continent. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
Leap in manufacturing and production is one of the major strategies within the framework of a resistant economy as it speeds up establishment of stable infrastructures. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said that the current trend of production and manufacturing in the country is insufficient and stressed the need for strengthening manufacture and production. The leader pointed to prohibition of imports as one of the prerequisites for leap in production. He said, "We're not opposed to imports, but we emphasize that the product that is made or can be made within the country shouldn't be imported." Dear listeners, agriculture is one of the key sectors in Iran's economy. The production of strategic crops is important in the sense that it contributes to the country's independence and provides the path for reaching an ideal economy. Stay with us for more. Presently, there are three staple crops which play a basic role in the basket of Iranian families, namely wheat, rice, and oilseeds. Turning into a developed country with the first rank in the region in scientific, economic, and technological terms, and food security, especially the maximal production of strategic products, are among the main objectives of Iran's development plan, which have been addressed in the leader's statement for the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. No doubt, reaching the specific goals in the plan require development of human resources and proper application of scientific and technological principles in all sectors of the economy, with a leap in production, particularly in the agricultural sector. Oilseeds are considered as a source of energy as well as cereals. The oil has nutritious value for human beings, and the oil cake is used for food for livestock due to high amount of protein. These seeds are also used in industry. According to Ali Reza Mohajer, an expert in the Ministry of Agriculture, an important index for evaluation of food security in macro level is the rate of self-sufficiency of food products or the scale of provision of basic nutritious needs from the domestic production. This will not only enhance the country's global reputation, will also indicate the improvement of agricultural productivity, efficiency of capital and workforce in agriculture, effectiveness of government policies, and rural development. These factors will lead to economic growth, saving of hard currencies and foreign exchange, reduction of dependence, and reinforcement of national security. Because of Iran's diverse climate and a highly trained and efficient workforce, a survey of successful countries has indicated that cultivation of oilseeds shows that Iran can minimize its dependence on these products. Not long ago, production of oilseeds was limited to just soybeans, sunflower, and cottonseed, mainly in northern Iranian provinces. Currently, however, Canola seed has been prioritized due to climatic conditions, autumn cultivation, and little need for water. Presently, near 220,000 hectares of land have been dedicated to the cultivation of canola seed. Thus, it is estimated that over 400,000 tons of canola will be harvested from the farms. In view of this, more than 30% of foreign exchange has been allocated to the production and extraction of oil seeds annually, so that over $41 billion has been the value of oil seeds imported for the past 25 years. To put it more simply, the dependence rate has been nearly 90%, which leads to high vulnerability, especially at times of sanctions. It has been planned to cultivate approximately 70,000 hectares of land with soybean to yield some 160,000 tons of the seed, 20,000 hectares with sunflower to yield nearly 30,000 tons of the seed, and 35,000 hectares have been dedicated to cultivating sesame seed to yield around 40,000 tons of the product. Increase in production of oil seeds will not only promote job creation and secure parts of national need for nutritious oil, it will also provide oil cake for consumption in animal husbandry. Thus, it can indirectly contribute to securing protein and solve the per capita energy consumption in the country. Self-sufficiency in production of oil seeds is considered very important, and the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has highlighted this issue in previous years. He has said, "We should reach self-sufficiency in the field of oil seeds, especially canola seed. As it was mentioned, canola can be cultivated in autumn and can benefit from autumn rainfall. It can be cultivated in various provinces of Iran and can be cultivated alternatively with other cereals. The high quality of canola has turned it into one of the best oils to produce. Furthermore, its cultivation has positive effect in sustainability of production, controlling cereal diseases, better functioning of the next product, and improvement of agricultural soils in general. In order to enhance health conditions and decrease consumption of harmful oils, the cultivation of oil seeds such as canola has been seriously put on the agenda of Iran's agricultural ministry."
The debate.
A group of 15 rights groups urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. The group, which includes the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy and Amnesty International, wrote in a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration would place the pursuit of profit before people. Back in 2017, Trump said there won't be strain with this administration when it comes to U.S.-Bahrain ties. Under Trump, Manama secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. Bahrain has engaged in a widespread crackdown on opposition groups and human rights activist since 2011 when the country's rulers faced nationwide pro-democracy protests calling for the removal of the Ali Khalifa regime.
More than a dozen rights groups have urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to restrict arms sales to Bahrain and address, quote, severe deterioration of human rights under the Al Khalifa regime. A letter signed by 15 groups, including the Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy, Amnesty International, and the World Organization Against Torture, has been sent to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The letter calls on Washington to pressure Manama over a span on opposition political parties and independent media, and demand an end to the suppression of activists, the use of torture, and other ill-treatment. It also urges the Biden administration to adopt a rights-based foreign policy toward Bahrain. The Bahraini regime has been cracking down on dissent since 2011 popular uprising against the Al Khalifa dynasty. Amid deafening silence of the then U.S. administration under Barack Obama and his successor Donald Trump, the kingdom went on with its heavy-handed tactic, killing and arresting activists and opposition figures. A recent report by London-based Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy shows at least 51 people have been sentenced to death since 2011 in the tiny Persian Gulf island. Rights groups say Trump's public disdain for international human rights emboldened the Al Khalifa regime. They say Trump even sold $8.5 million worth of arms to Bahrain. The signatories of the letter have urged Biden to live up to his campaign promises of fighting for democracy and pressure Bahrain to introduce democratic reforms. The letter comes as the Biden administration is facing criticism for failing to hold Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman accountable for his role in the gruesome murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That after a declassified U.S. intelligence report publicly accused bin Salman of approving Khashoggi's assassination in the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul in 2018. Washington's failure to take practical steps to bring bin Salman to justice once again exposes double standards in dealing with the criminals and rights abusers and its support for dictators. It also proved that the Biden administration's policies differ from those of Trump's only in rhetoric, not in essence. Ironically, such stance under regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain would simply embolden them to carry on their grave violations of human rights at home and beyond their borders.
Joining us on this debate, we have former British ambassador to Bahrain, Mr. Peter Ford, joining us from Manchester. Also joining us on the line from London, we have Mr. Masoud Shajara from the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ford in Manchester. A group of 15 rights bodies has urged the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to address the deterioration of human rights in Bahrain. A part of the letter said that we hope that your administration will ensure that human rights are once again placed at the center of U.S. foreign policy in Bahrain, also calling for that in the wider Persian Gulf region. Share with us your thoughts on that letter.
Well, the initiative is well timed. It was just this week, a couple of days ago, that Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, made an important speech proclaiming that under Biden, America was going to be keen once more on spreading democracy and supporting human rights. Biden himself signed off on an important strategy document underlining that commitment. And here we have these 15 groups calling for America to put its money where its mouth is with regards to Bahrain, where the human rights situation is truly appalling, going from bad to worse.
Mr. Shajara, in London, the group wrote in the letter addressed to the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, that you noted that in too many countries, people are imprisoned and face torture or death for speaking their minds, reporting the news, or demanding their rights. This statement sadly reflects the situation in Bahrain over the last 4 years. Mr. Shajara, I think it's safe to say that it's not just the last 4 years in Bahrain, and it's not just in Bahrain, is it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, we are. There is wanting articulation of supporting human rights and justice and democracy. We have heard this from the variety of administration from the United States, but in practice and in reality, definitely in the region of Middle East, and not just Middle East, you're seeing exactly opposite that. You know, we're seeing that dictators are being encouraged to continue their dictatorship and encouraged to implement these policies of barbaric policies of torture, imprisonment, and indeed they are continuously being supported. And there is some people complain that this is double standard, but when you look at the whole history and the recent history, be it Obama's administration or Trump's administration or indeed the current administration, we are seeing this same situation. So it's not a double standard. Unfortunately, it's a one standard, which it's sort of legitimized hypocrisy and abuse and torture. You know, we just look at the Bahrainis cannot implement these policies without help and support directly from the West and United States. Even, their torturers and the police and their army are being organized and sort of supported by indeed Americans and British ex-police officers, MI5 officers, etc. So really, I think it's very honorable for people to ask that, and it's the right thing to ask for, but I think we shouldn't be holding our breath.
Mr. Ford, under former President Trump, Bahrain secured over $8.5 billion in arms deals. The group of rights bodies said Bahrain's rulers were emboldened by President Trump, sending a clear message that his administration will place the pursuit of profit before people. Will it be any different now? Because that specific U.S. policy of having profit over people, it hardly ever changes.
Well, Bahrain has taken out an insurance policy in the shape of normalizing relations with Israel. They know very well that the way to America's heart is through Israel, and that is precisely where they have gone. Last year, they moved quickly towards normalization, and every month almost brings a new development. Very recently, Crown Prince Salman invited Mr. Netanyahu to visit Bahrain. So just in case the arms purchases aren't enough to guarantee an American blind eye to human rights abuse, the Bahrainis have gone very deeply into a new relationship with Israel, including a security and intelligence relationship. They even have Israeli companies providing spyware to use against Bahraini citizens.
Mr. Shajareh, our guest in Manchester, he just mentioned the issue of Israel. As we know, Bahrain was among Arab nations that signed normalization agreements with the Israeli regime in 2020 during the Trump administration. Will Washington now want to get harsh with Manama after they've cozied up to the Israeli regime, surely agreeing to reap its benefits from Washington as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to point out that this cozy relationship has not been just come after so-called normalization. This has been going on for a very long time. All we saw it was the sort of public acknowledgement of this relationship. And indeed, I have to say that I agree with the other participants that it's not about the money. I mean, the amount of money that has been coming in through Bahrain or even Saudi Arabia, in the proportion to our GDP, in proportion of our export overall, it's really much less than even point something percent And so really that is not something that breaking the deal. They're breaking the deal because they are actually doing the bidding of the United States and Israel. And they are oppressing their own people. They're torturing their own people. They're undermining their legitimate needs and aspirations. And as long as they are going to be sort of the agent of United States and Israel and so forth, and supporting and providing what they need to be provided in the region, it's very clear that they are being given sort of ability and the right to go and kill and torture their own people. And this is what is so sad. And, you know, this policy was the policy which was implemented elsewhere in the world. And this is a very short-sighted policy of trying to buy favor with a nation. Because eventually people of Bahrain, like others, are going to sort of hold their leaders accountable. And then they're going to have a different view vis-a-vis United States or Israel and the West as a whole, who have been instrumental in the sort of denying them the empowerment of deciding their own future.
Mr. Ford, you mentioned the Bahrainis, they do have a sense of security right now by normalizing ties with Israel. There's another side to that security card as well, having in mind that Bahrain is home to the U.S.'s 5th Fleet. Do you think that regionally it's too far-fetched even to expect any major change in approach towards Manama, no matter who the president is?
I'm not at all optimistic for the reason you just cited, the presence of an important base for the Gulf base for the U.S., the 5th Fleet. Bahrain, for many years, has been strategically important to the United States. Going forward, the U.S. strategists may realize that having ships so close to the Iranian coast is not really a good strategy, and what they consider assets are, in fact, liabilities, so that Manama could turn out to be a bit like Pearl Harbor if things got really, really bad. It's noteworthy that when things got very hot with Iran 18 months ago in the Gulf, the main U.S. Ships were withdrawn from the Gulf and parked 1,000 miles away. So the usefulness of that Bahraini base may have a sell-by date on it. But certainly for the duration of the Biden presidency, I'm afraid that consideration will weigh heavily with the Americans, and I don't expect the slightest real pressure to be put on Bahrain.
Mr. Shajara, the protests in Bahrain in 2011, they came amid similar uprisings in the region. There was Tunisia, Egypt, Libya, Yemen. The U.S. and company, they went on to pick and choose who they supported and who they didn't. Back then, it was the Obama administration in office. Joe Biden was the vice president. That inconsistency and hypocrisy on the issue of human rights, it was even evident back then as well.
Absolutely. I think it really is extremely bad policy which United States is pursuing. As my colleague said, that it really is the base is a liability. And I would say that even sort of these normalization and this sort of treatment of being obedient servants of interests of the West, and then oppressing your own people, it actually brings insecurity long term. If Bahrain indeed moved towards democracy at that time, when there was the sort of Arab Spring, or it would have actually ensured much more secure position. And the oppositions weren't asking for anything extreme. The opposition were extremely well organized. It wasn't like the situation that we have seen in Libya, where the whole country went into the turmoil. I really think that now what we could see, indeed, because of this policy that is being pursued by the United States with the support of Israel and some other regional countries, indeed is going to bring instability. You can't sort of create a conflict or promote a conflict with Iran and certain parts of a region without bringing insecurity and instability to the whole region.
One last question for Mr. Ford. We have about 30 seconds left. Why has, in your opinion, the mainstream media kept silent on all that has happened in Bahrain? The crackdowns, the arrests, the death sentences, the stripping of citizenships. Very briefly, if you may.
Well, it's inconvenient and therefore is ignored. The mainstream media would much rather talk about Syria, for example, where, with regards to human rights, the situation is certainly no worse than it is in Bahrain. Bahrain doesn't fit the narrative. No pressure is going to be put on Bahrain, and therefore Bahrain can get away with almost anything, which is tragic because the people of Bahrain are very civilized, very sophisticated, and represent no threat to stability if they are allowed to say in